Hi, it's January 24th, another Friday, and this is the third edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, and it features a father and son. I'm John, the boomer, pollster for 35 years, an author, sometimes a thought leader, and I've been watching politics and culture for a long, long time now.
And I'm Jeremy Zogby, the millennial, a partner with my dad at John Zogby Strategies. I started my career as a history teacher in the lovely city of Prague, Czech Republic. I continued to teach at the college level and the high school level in history, world history, comparative history, political ideologies, among other things. And I've been partner with my dad for 3 years now. So, Dad, we're in two different locations. I'm up here in central New York, and you're down in Washington, D.C., and I just wanted to kick off the program because you're on the ground in the belly of the beast. What's the mood there? You can tell everyone listening before we get into our program here.
Well, down here, it's all impeachment all the time because politics is the major industry in town. And so not surprisingly, that's what the cab drivers want to talk about. That's what the hotel clerks talk about. That's the buzz as you're walking up and down the street. So many people make a living from politics and government. Needless to say, in Washington these days, there's a chasm between those who live here and work here, and generally to the tune of 80%+ vote Democrat. They do not like the president of the United States. The flip side of that is when you get into the administration at all levels, what you find are a lot of government employees now at the level where they're political employees who support the president. And so this is the belly of the beast on impeachment.
So we have this week two big polls that we've released into the media. The first one was through the U.S. Mayors, Conference of Mayors, rather. And, of course, there was just an event that you spoke at about our findings of 18 to 29-year-old likely voters nationwide. How did that go? What was the sense of when you were delivering the numbers? And, of course, tell us some of the highlights of what you delivered. How did the mayors, of course, this conference was attended by mayors from all over the country. How did that go?
Mayors are very smart people, and they have to be smart on a daily basis. And there's no hiding from America's problems because they preside over America's most intimate problems of crime and violence, jobs, the economy, education, and the environment. And so in that sense, then, this was a large group in the room at the time when I was speaking, somewhere close to 600 people, many of whom were mayors of cities, large and small. They had just finished talking about gun violence in their cities, and there were really heartbreaking problems that they have to deal with, and especially on the front lines. Our poll, as you mentioned, 1,000 18 to 29-year-old likely voters nationwide. We stayed away from the horse races on the presidential election. We wanted to know what the young people are actually really thinking about these major issues. And you know, needless to say, no surprise, the number one issue is the economy, and the number two is healthcare. But right up there were guns and violence and the environment. And we saw that firsthand, in our polling.
Sure. And if you were to say, based on the experience you had there, what was their general takeaway? What is going to be their call to action after hearing about the data and engaging in this event? When they go back to their cities, and many of these mayors, by the way, have formed youth coalitions, what are they likely to tackle? What's top of the agenda?
Well, that's what was most impressive about this conference, but then also about what they announced at their conference, and that is that they have formed youth councils. not every mayor, but most mayors have in their cities, youth councils of 18 to 29 year olds. Some cities, in fact, including some of the best known names following the Parkland shootings and other activities that have taken place. But these youth councils are not only designed to be a sounding board, but also to be an advisory on making policy. These are youth activists. They're very mature. They, in fact, had a panel reacting to our poll. The important thing is, and the message both from the polling and the message that the mayors got, was that we're not just talking about an interesting and very different group of young people who are small in numbers. We're actually talking about the next wave of the electorate, the next wave of employees in the city, the next wave of leadership. And it's time to engage. You know, as you know, Jer, one of the many significant pieces that we found in the poll were that more than one in three of these young people that we polled don't really necessarily believe that their vote is going to count in the next election. And so forming these youth councils is a way of staving off some real skepticism that anything could get done.
And we should also mention that the other poll that we released this week is going to be a longstanding relationship with Forbes, more specifically their under 30 a section of Forbes.com. So I'll talk a little bit about this relationship. This is Forbes under 30, a poll of voters under likely voters under 30, powered by John Zogby Strategies. We're going to be polling the 18 to 29-year-old likely voters over the next 10 months leading up to the 2020 election. And it's what's very important here is you just highlighted this, that if any of the candidates can harness and unleash the power of the youth vote, that has the consequence of turning elections. I'd also like to point out that, and there's been some going back and forth going on this, but this is going to be the biggest poll of its kind. We do know that Harvard does a biannual poll of 18 to 29-year-old likely voters nationwide of 3,000 18 to 29-year-olds. But this, each month, we're going to be doing a fresh sample of 1,000. And so over the course of 10 months, that's 10,000 people polled. So let's get into the numbers on those findings. First, we'll look at the Democratic primary and caucus likely voters. We wanted to know from them, who's their top guy? We pit all the candidates up against each other. And of course, by no surprise, Bernie Sanders came out on top, really on top, with 32% of in the poll. Biden came in at 16%. Elizabeth Warren and Michael Bloomberg came in at 9%. Andrew Yang came in at 8%. And then, of course, Steyer got 4%. And then Tulsi Gabbard, and this was shocking. There was a lot of buzz in the media about this yesterday. Pete Buttigieg getting 3%, as well as Tulsi Gabbard. How do you make sense of that?
Well, first of all, the Pete Buttigieg thing, you know, it's interesting. While he is indeed the youngest person in the race, he and Tulsi Gabbard, 38 years old now, he just turned 38. The important thing is that he's not running as the youngest candidate, and he's not running as a generational candidate either. What you don't have is the John F. Kennedy, you know, the torch is passed to a new generation, or a Barack Obama talking about the audacity of hope. Pete Buttigieg is running as a smart, competent, now former mayor, but apparently a lack of inspiration there, and certainly not as well known as some of the other candidates to this young age cohort. But it was intriguing that he wasn't picking up more of the younger age cohort, and it's apparent now as we look at these numbers that maybe it was because he wasn't really going after 18 to 29 year olds, and it shows.
You know, by my estimation, if you ask me, right, why is, for example, Biden very popular? Well, I know that Biden projects himself as the candidate that's best poised to defeat Trump. What about Bernie Sanders? Bernie Sanders is the guy who's been telling us for the last however many years that he's going to bring us a political revolution. Elizabeth Warren, who came in at third place, why is she still kind of a contender in the polls with this group? Well, because she is the one who owns the issue of Medicare for all. If you talk about Pete Buttigieg, well, I know his story. I know that he's a former mayor of South Bend, Indiana. I know that he's a very smart guy, Harvard educated. And it's a very cute story that he's a mayor and he's young and that he's taking on this role to run for president. But I don't know why he's going to win. He hasn't really communicated that too well. What do you think about that notion? Has he missed with his message? What is his message to defeat Trump?
Well, I think basically what it is that he knows he's smart. There's nothing wrong with that. And also that the Democratic Party is lacking in terms of its appeal to blue collar and to rural voters. And of course, the first a battle is Iowa, you know, predominantly a rural state in the Midwest. He's a neighbor in Indiana and a small city, South Bend, Indiana. He talks the talk. He's part of that culture. And traditionally, if you look at the history of the Iowa caucuses, whenever there's been somebody from Iowa or a neighboring state, that person has done well in the Iowa caucuses. And so that was his calculus, that he could stand out as being, you know, the smartest young man in the room who was also a neighbor and appealed that maybe none of the other candidates who were members of the so-called Washington elite could show. In that, he's vying for the same kind of support as Amy Klobuchar, neighboring state of Minnesota, but, you know, has a long Washington record or a record of success and has won a lot of statewide elections in Oklahoma, including crossover support from Republicans. Pete Buttigieg had his moment has had his moment in the sun. He has begun to fade already. Obviously anything can happen. I want to a little bit later with you talk about the nature of the Iowa caucuses, but at least for now it looks like Buttigieg has flagged a little bit.
If Pete Buttigieg were listening right now, what would you tell him to do? What does he need to do?
Well, right now it's all up to the ground game, is to make sure that his people are on the phones and knocking on doors. I'm sure that they're doing that. But he also has to change his message, and he has to now try to cut in to Bernie's support among 18 to 29-year-olds. I think that's the only place for him to go.
So, and I want to get to what your take on being on the ground and what it's like to experience the Iowa caucuses, how it works. But let's move right now to the all voters of our poll. We were just talking about Democratic primary and caucus likely voters. This is where we look at all 1,000 of those who were polled. And so we matched the top Democratic candidates up against Trump and Sanders. This is how it went. Sanders versus Trump, he would get 58% of the vote if the election were held today. Trump would get 34, and then 8% would be undecided. Next would be Biden versus Trump. He got 51%. Trump got 35% in that matchup, leaving 14% undecided. Coming in third, Warren versus Trump. Elizabeth Warren gets 51%. Donald Trump gets 36%, 13% undecided. And then here was a surprise. Yang versus Trump, he was the one who did the fourth best, coming in at 52% of the vote, with Trump getting 34% and 14% undecided. You want to break those numbers down a little bit for us?
Yeah, I do. So we go back to the last victorious Democrat. That was Barack Obama, who got 66% of the 18 to 29-year-old vote in 2008, followed that with 61% of the 18 to 29-year-olds in 2012. Those were strong turnouts, and those were big margins that he won by. Hillary Clinton did not do so well against Donald Trump among 18 to 29-year-olds. And what these numbers are telling me is that Bernie, at 58 to 34, has a 24-point lead. That's about Obama territory. And 58% at this point in time shows that he's in a better position to match Obama in the 60s, you know, 61 or 66 like Obama got. And there are very few undecideds. When I look at the other candidates and I see them at 51 or 52%, leading only by 14, 15, 16 points, tells me there not only is a lot of work to do, but what should be troublesome are the 14 to 15% who are undecided among 18 to 29-year-olds. They're probably not going to vote for Trump, but the large number of undecideds at this point tells me they may not vote at all. That could be deadly. That could be deadly for a Democratic candidate.
We also asked a series of questions about impeachment. These mm-hmm. numbers are fascinating. In the first question, we asked the 18 to 29-year-old likely voters if they agreed or disagreed that Trump is guilty of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. A solid majority, 59%, said that they agree. 33%, keeping in line with our horse race numbers there, disagreed. And the follow-up question, we asked, should he be removed by Senate? 54% agreed that he should. 37% disagreed. And then this is probably the most fascinating. The next follow-up question was whether or not the likely voters had trust in the ability of Congress to conduct a fair impeachment of President Trump. 48% distrust, only 39% trust Congress to conduct the fair impeachment.
This says a lot of things right here. First of all, it explains why Bernie Sanders is so popular among young people, because there appears, at least to them, to be somebody who's direct and authentic. In fact, that was one of the questions that we asked: who's the most authentic and who cares the most about people like you and me? And Bernie won that hands down. Tells me they're skeptical about the system. And it also tells me that there's a moral code. I mean, they can judge whether the president is right or wrong, legal or illegal. However, do they feel that the process is right or wrong, or legal or illegal? And they just don't trust that process. And that, I think, in a nutshell, is what's wrong in the United States today. The system itself seems to have lost the trust of a lot of people, and particularly young people here.
Sure. And in other news around the world, of course, another major story of the week was the gatherings at Davos. I followed this story the whole week, and I couldn't help but be reminded of the novel A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, especially the line, "This is the best of times, this is the worst of times." If you listen to Donald Trump, this is the best of times. He, of course, showboated the greatest economy in the world, and that the United States was the envy and the gold standard in terms of standard of living. And then on the other side, you had the 17-year-old activist Greta Thunberg, who was reminding the most powerful people in the world that our house is on fire. An interesting matchup there of Trump versus Greta. What did you make of it?
Well, first of all, anytime a grown man, and especially a very powerful grown man, gets into a one-on-one battle with a 17-year-old young woman, the old man loses. And so that was kind of inappropriate. Secondly, there is obviously the generational thing. The president of the United States, who is right now the greatest polluter in the world, of the United States, is denying that that there is climate change when, regardless of what your point of view is, young people, 18 to 29-year-olds, represented by this 17-year-old, believe strongly, as our poll for the U.S. Conference of Mayors showed, that the global warming is indeed a major crisis that threatens human beings and other living organisms as we presently know them. So we have this generational battle, and it tells me that this is emblematic. We know that folks my age and Donald Trump's age are not going to be around all that much longer. Folks like Greta and her age cohort are going to be. So in the mid to longer run, they're going to win. And is the president of the United States speaking for the majority of Americans, or for that matter, a majority of the rest of the world? And plenty of evidence to show that he is not.
Now, I have to point out, and I know people know that you're a boomer, but maybe people don't know that you're 71 years old. And I'm just curious, as a 71-year-old, how do you feel about a 17-year-old telling the most elite of the world what to do, and shame on them? What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, to some degree, much the same way as I might feel about a 36-year-old telling me to be ashamed of myself. however, yeah, that's pretty heady stuff. But look, I do know that she's very intense. You know, let's be aware of the fact that we know that the young woman is diagnosed as being on the spectrum. So there may be, you know, some social virtues that may be lacking. Nonetheless, though, I do think she represents an intensity. And there's a reason why she was invited and not someone else. And that is because she does represent the intensity of what so many young people feel is a very intense issue.
Well, you know, Steve Mnuchin's comment, the Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, his comment seemed to dominate. He told Greta, you know, basically, in paraphrasing, why don't you first get your bachelor's degree in economics and then do the math? And that was the talk of the town. But actually, historian Neil Ferguson, famous historian Neil Ferguson, had a comment that I thought was pretty interesting. In the first part of the comment, he called out Greta and he said, "Hey, you know, you fly to New York City, you fly to London and Davos, but why aren't you going to Delhi? Why aren't you going to Beijing? India and China are two of the biggest CO2 emitters in the world." And then the other quote that he said, which I thought was pretty revealing, was he said, you know, Greta had this wonderful speech that she gave to the world's elite, and publicly they were eating it up. They thought it was great. But he said, "I know for sure," quote, "that privately they're more or less agreeing with Trump in terms of how do we get our economy kickstarted? How do we get it going through the roof?" And, you know, it could be interpreted as a little bit harsh, but, you know, can somebody get away with critiquing or calling out Greta, or is that just a wrong thing to do? Is that something nobody should go down that road?
Well, if you go down that road in critiquing a 17-year-old young woman, it's risky. And it's risky for a lot of politically correct reasons. You know, we see that even in the presidential campaign. You know, do you feel a woman can win the presidency? got to be careful of your answer. Nonetheless, you know, the debate is enjoined. The president said what he said. Mnuchin, Ferguson said what they said. She did too. This is the battle of the age cohorts right now. One group that feels, yeah, it's the economy at all costs. Let's make sure that we continue to make progress, creating jobs, ending poverty, which we're doing, actually. Maybe not fast enough, but we are doing. Giving people not only income, but hope, versus a wave of a new generation. Remember, there's by far and away the majority of this planet who are people under 30 who feel extremely intense feelings about the environment. And here we had this incredible showdown between two people who are more than five decades, almost six decades apart in age.
Let's take this conversation full circle, and we opened up with the election, and you said you wanted to talk a little bit about the process and the nature of the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah, we've got to understand the Iowa caucuses are not the secret ballot that we normally see, even in primaries. Go behind a curtain, you cast your ballot, and then it's between you and whoever. Caucuses are very public. They can take place in firehouses, libraries, gymnasiums, and whatever. And the person running the caucus, these are the Democratic caucuses now, says, okay, all of those of you who are with Bernie Sanders, get in this corner. Joe Biden, get over here. Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, get in your respective places. Then they're tabulated. This is all public. You're with your neighbors, your friends, your cohorts, the fellow parents, you know, at the public school or whatever. And if your candidate within that room does not get 15%, then that candidate's supporters are then told, go somewhere else. So now let's say, go with another candidate. So let's say I started out with Biden, and I feel very strongly that my second choice is Bernie Sanders. But I see that all my friends are with Biden. And I start to head over to Sanders, and I hear, Trish, you're not really going to go over there, are you? And someone says, well, we had a play date together on Saturday, but it looks like your child cannot play with my child. You're making a terrible choice. And so Trish backs off and says she'll go with Biden. There's a very strange dynamic going on here. And I think that people need to understand all this is public, and there are many more factors that explain this process than just simply who do I like or who do I want to be the next president of the United States.
Well, that about does it for our third edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. We will look forward to next week, and well, I'll just say one thing right now. Of course, the big story of today is the coronavirus in China. That's not something that, you know, is your expertise or my expertise, but because of its ability to roil the markets and its potential to bring leaders together if there is a problem, that's something that we're going to be watching this morning. And if possible, or if need be, we may mention it next week. But until then, have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, thanks. Two cases now in the United States, so we'll be looking at it too. Have a great week. Thanks.
Possibly three. See you.